This episode of Walter Edgar's Journal is an encore of a previously broadcast program.
Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the Scanna studio today are Herb Fraser, Dr. Bernard Powers, and Marjorie Wentworth, who collaborated on a book called We Are Charleston. It is a story of the tragedy at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston and its aftermath, what's going on in Charleston today. Herb is a journalist. Bernie, longtime friend and frequent visitor to the Journal, is a professor at the College of Charleston, and Marjorie is our state's poet laureate. So, first of all, that's an interesting group, but welcome to the Journal.
Well, thank you. Good to be here.
Marjorie, I think you opened the chapter with how this all came about, and I think it was on first learning about the tragedy at Mother Emanuel.
I didn't hear about it till the next day. I went to bed early that night and had all these voice messages and texts and knew something horrible had happened and opened up the paper and read it and just kind of fell over. Most people were up all night, though. I think, the night before.
Bernie, you
Walter, I was actually out of the country. I was in Tobago, and a friend called me on the cell phone, and before he completely told me what had happened, the connection dropped. And all I got was there was a shooting at Mother Emanuel. So I'm thinking that someone had gotten shot on the street outside of the church. So anyway, we normally watch CNN, and we turned on CNN. We didn't hear anything unusual for about 2 hours. And then the stories began to come across the station, and we found out that people had been killed inside of the church.
So this has become an international story because
yes.
You're in the Caribbean.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's right.
Okay. And Herb?
Well, I went to bed kind of early that night, and one of my daughters called me at 10 o'clock and said, "Daddy, there was a shooting at your church." I said, "What do you mean by that?" And I got up and I turned on the TV and I saw that there were a lot of emergency vehicles down in that area of the church. And my wife and I, we got in the car and we went down there, but we couldn't get very close. And we heard also on the radio that they were still looking for a shooter or a suspect, somebody who'd done this. And we could see a helicopter flying over the area and a lot of armed police officers on the street. And so since no one had been arrested, we decided to go home. We thought it'd be best place to go home and watch this unfold on television. And we stayed up all night. And the next day, you know, just completely drained emotionally. Because I grew up in Emanuel, and I have friends. I have some relatives who still attend the church there. And so it was a night that none of us will ever forget.
What did y'all start doing the next day? I mean...
Well, I think the community, and we write about this in the book, you know, the community through its already connected relationships in the interfaith community, immediately the community started to come together, and because people needed a way to express the grief and the sorrow. I didn't attend the event. I had to work that day, but there was a large gathering, a prayer vigil at Morris Brown AME Church, in which there were just... an enormous crowd. It was a hot day in Charleston. The police were handing out water. There were a variety of speakers because people couldn't get into the church. The church was packed when we write about this. And after that, there began to be another series of events that gave the community an opportunity to vent a lot of this emotion. And of course, you know, by that Friday, the next day, you know, everyone breathed a sigh of relief because a suspect was arrested, you know. And then the surprise came on Friday with the expression of forgiveness by some of the family members of some of the victims during the bond hearing.
Let's go back to the church itself. Mother Emanuel, and the four of us know what that term means, but let's talk about, you know, how this church came about and how it is embedded and intertwined with the entire history of South Carolina and the question of slavery. Barney, do you want to take that?
Sure, sure. So Walter, Mother Emmanuel really was the earliest AME church established in the Deep South. So its history goes back to the slave period. It goes back to the beginnings of African Americans in the Methodist Church in the South, and there were African Americans in Philadelphia who established their own branch of Methodism. They had been a part of the white Methodist Church, but they just could not tolerate the racial discrimination that continued to exist in that denomination. And there were some that believed that black people ought to control their own religious destiny. And with that as a background, we see the creation of the AME Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, which was established by the founding bishop of the denomination in the 1780s in Philadelphia. Richard Allen was the founder of the church. And the AME Church was the first African-American denomination in the entire country. It has a history of social activism and a commitment to social justice. And, of course, during that time period, the greatest issue that black people faced was, of course, slavery. And so the AME Church is an anti-slavery church. It has had that as part of its social gospel mission, in addition to of course, teaching the routine doctrines of Methodism and so on. What happens eventually in Charleston is we'll see an exodus of black Charlestonians from the white Methodist Church here, and that occurs in late 1817, early 1818, and the man who led that exodus is a man by the name of Morris Brown. And Morris Brown, a free black Charlestonian, would go up to Philadelphia and meet with Richard Allen and establish now in Charleston the southernmost branch of the AME Church, and during that time period it was simply known as the African Church. This really was a revolutionary act, because what happened essentially was we see the foundation of an abolitionist church, a black church, in the city of Charleston, in literally the heart of the slaveholding region of the country.
And it is a congregation of free persons of color as well as those who were enslaved.
That's right. That's right. And the largest percentage of the members of the church would have been enslaved people. And of course, this congregation could never receive the approval of the authorities, and there'd be a period of arrest and harassment. And eventually, the church was actually closed under the authority of the municipal government of Charleston because it was determined that some of the members of the congregation had been involved in a slave conspiracy, a conspiracy to encourage slaves to revolt and take their freedom. And that would lead to the end of this first period of independent black Methodism in the city of Charleston, and there would be no black Methodist church in the city until after the Civil War, when the congregation was resurrected. In fact, the chapter in which we discuss this particular theme, the rebuilding and the reconstruction of black Methodism, independent black Methodism in the city of Charleston, we call that chapter Resurrection. And so in that regard, after the Civil War, indeed, by the end of 1865, members of this congregation have come back together. These would have been older people, and they began to now recreate the original congregation, which now for the first time becomes known as Emmanuel. And it's the flagship congregation for African Methodism in the South, and therefore we referred to it as Mother Emmanuel, and a number of other AME churches in the state, as well as in other places, as far away as Florida and Alabama, would be spawned out of this original congregation.
Bethel here in Columbia, which is sometimes referred to as Big Bethel, mm-hmm. is one of those churches that
That's right.
came out of
That's
Mother
right.
Emmanuel.
That's right. So.
And the slave conspiracy you mentioned was, of course, Denmark Vesey.
Yes, that's right. That's so. Right. And Denmark Vesey was a class leader in this congregation before the Civil War, a free black, a man who had been a slave but managed to become free, but was deeply committed to the freedom of other people. And when it was determined that Vesey and some other members of the congregation had been implicated in this slave conspiracy, that provided the momentum then for the authorities to prosecute Vesey and others, send some out of the state, but a number of people, including Vesey, were executed as a result, and the congregation dispersed.
Let's move into the resurrection. And as you say, Emmanuel in Charleston becomes a mother church or the flagship church for the denomination throughout the South. And it quickly becomes one of the largest churches, period, in the state, is it not?
That's right. That's right. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, there's something else about the denomination and Mother Emmanuel that's important, too, that I'd like to mention. And that is, you know, African Methodism has a strain of black nationalism embedded within it. And that essentially means only that there's this philosophy that people of African descent ought to come together, pool their resources, and to do whatever was necessary to improve the quality of their lives, to gain control over their lives, and so on and so forth. And so one of the things that the members of this congregation took great pride in was that when that church in 1865 and afterwards was being constructed, all of the workers on the job site were black workers, were black laborers employed here on the job site, and probably a lot of them would have been members of the congregation also.
Okay. Well, Herb, you grew up in Emmanuel.
Yes. Yes.
Why don't you talk about that, growing up in that church? You know, again, today, in the aftermath of that tragedy and Mother Emmanuel, the huge church building, I think folks still are under the impression it was a mega church when you were growing up.
It was several hundred members, of course. That was in the 50s and 60s when I was a member of Emmanuel. And when I was a child there, I did not know of the church's rich history. However, and they apparently either they taught it and I wasn't listening or they didn't teach it. But I do remember quite vividly, because Emmanuel was very tied to Allen University here in Columbia, of course. And my grandmother, who was a member of the church, who made sure that I went to church and I went to Sunday school, she would always say, when you go to college, you are going to Allen. And one of the people we feature in the book is Reverend Hilda Scott. It was Reverend Hilda Scott who chose me to represent the church at a Sunday school convention in 1961, I believe. We stayed at the dorm at Allen University, met some of the football players when Allen had a football team. I remember quite vividly walking down Main Street in Columbia, seeing the state capitol building, going into the state capitol building, and I'm 11 years old, and I sat at the desk of a representative from Lee County, because my middle name is Lee. And so I remember all of that sort of kind of opened my eyes to a world outside of Charleston. And I knew that I was going to go to Allen, and I knew of the importance of the church as it relates to higher education. Very important. Going back to the community, Ansonborough, that neighborhood immediately around the church, was a predominantly black neighborhood. There were a lot of black businesses along Calhoun Street. I lived with my grandmother in Anson-Boro housing, public housing, federal housing project, which is at the east end of Calhoun Street. It's not there anymore. And all of that area was a kind of a sanctuary of sorts. It was a segregated community. It had everything you needed. We had the church, and there were a couple other churches in the community. And, of course, I went to school at Buist Elementary School, which is now a public charter school. So for me, as a kid of the 50s and 60s, the church and the school and that neighborhood was the center of my universe. And I felt very protected and very nurtured, very well nurtured within that church.
And when you came here in Allen in 61,
yes,
mm-hmm. The civil rights movement had not really started in terms of student participation mm-hmm. yet. It would mm-hmm. do that while you were at Allen.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did you participate?
No, I was too young to participate, and we write about this in the book. Reverend Benjamin Glover, who later became one of Allen's presidents, he was the pastor at Emmanuel at that time. By 1963, the summer of 63, he was one of many ministers who led the youth protest movement to desegregate the lunch counters along King Street in Charleston. He had, you know, he was a native of Greenwood County. He was already, before he came to Charleston, he was already somewhat of a revolutionary guy. He was beaten almost to death by the Ku Klux Klan in Greenwood County when he walked up to the courthouse steps to register to vote. He was a minister, and I think he had a small congregation, I believe, in 96. He was transferred to a small church here, AME Church here in Columbia, and then he became pastor of Emmanuel in 1955, I believe it was. And it was by the early 60s that I was old enough to begin to understand him and how he interacted with people in the church. But again, I was a little bit too young, and my parents, my grandmother, they did not talk much about the civil rights movement.
And there were some people in Emmanuel who thought that the Reverend Mr. Glover was going a little bit too far, too fast, and he shouldn't be involving the young folks.
That's right. And the same, some of the same sentiment was felt towards Reverend Pinckney, that he was a legislator, that maybe he should be paying more, a little bit more attention to his flock in Charleston and not spending so much time in Columbia in legislative matters.
Well, but by the time Senator Pinckney got there, the congregation was several hundred. It's a relatively small congregation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Bernie, you are a member of the AME Church, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
And there are, what, four or five AME churches in Charleston?
Oh, at least.
But Mother Emmanuel's one of the smaller ones.
Yes, that's right.
But because it's a downtown.
Right.
Because of the gentrification that changed that neighborhood and took a lot of the members outside of the central core of the city.
Mother Emmanuel is experiencing today what a lot of downtown churches are experiencing, and that is just the dispersal of the original members to the outlying areas. They want to go to churches that are closer to where they reside, and so we see the size of congregations diminishing, and it becomes increasingly difficult to maintain these old structures. And so, for example, Daniel Jenkins' church, which is in downtown Charleston, is going to be placed on the market now simply because the congregation has diminished so considerably in size, and they cannot afford to maintain it.
Well, didn't the Citadel Baptist Church have similar?
Yes,
that's
predominantly white congregation.
That's right.
Was literally falling down.
Yes, that's right. And my understanding is that they hold their worship services there in just a portion of the building.
Let's move on now to the nine men and women who lost their lives that night. And Marjorie, I think it might help if we just recited their names. Would you mind doing that from the book?
Sure, I think I can do it. Sharonda Coleman Singleton, Cynthia Graham Hurd, Susie Jackson, Ethel Lance, DePayne Middleton Doctor, Clemente Pinckney, Tawanza Sanders, Daniel Simmons, and Myra Thompson. And then we also always recognize Felicia Sanders and her granddaughter and Polly Shepherd, who were in the room, and Jennifer and Milana Pinckney were in Reverend Pinckney's office, which is just a doorway away. I mean, we're pretty sure that, you know, they certainly heard everything and, you know, had to live through that and know what was going on just a room away.
The story has been told many times, but I think it still bears repeating. On that fateful night, there was a Bible study going on, and this young white man walked in and asked to participate, sat down next to the Reverend Pinckney.
And he asked to sit next to him.
He asked
to,
him. Yeah. And then the Bible study went on for quite some time until he pulled the gun and began murdering folks.
Yeah, right.
And one of the interesting details is that normally Bible study would be around 6 o'clock, and there was a quarterly business meeting.
This is a congregational meeting, is that right?
Yes, right.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And many people, left. You know, it was hot. It was the end of the day. People hadn't had dinner, whatnot. And then the Bible study started. Didn't really start until. Late. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't want to think of what would have happened sooner. So that's just a lot of people are living, we think, with survivor's guilt. And, you know, people left, even people who got their license to minister that night. One person in particular, her air conditioning was broken, so she left. So we heard lots of stories like that. Mm-hmm. But it is unusual that it was so late.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm just thinking of something for the first time, based on what you said, Marjorie. It would have been unheard of for this fella to show up at the quarterly conference,
right.
The business meeting.
Wouldn't be
because
appropriate.
That's for members. That's members only.
Right.
But the prayer meeting, strangers would be welcome without question into mm-hmm. that session.
Yeah. And 2 days later, the family member, many of the family members stood up and said, I forgive you. I mean, that literally, I think, shocked the nation.
Really
and
did.
That plays into the faith in the AME church, does it not?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. And you know, we think about a situation that Richard Allen was in. And we talk about this in the book. Allen in Philadelphia, and he was very well known in Philadelphia as a church leader and for a number of other reasons. And he'd become free, but he was accused of being a fugitive. And as it turned out, the claims were completely trumped up, and the fellow who lodged the complaint and made the claims, this fellow was thrown in jail. But before this man had served out his term, Richard Allen intervened and had him released from jail, had him released early. And so that's highly suggestive of a level of forgiveness, certainly a lack of animosity, a lack of any desire for punishment. And that has kind of set the tone for the church. And indeed, that kind of story has been passed down over the years through the denomination. But these individuals who gave those gestures of forgiveness and expressions of forgiveness, I think we have to keep in mind that they were part of a very special group of people, members of families who were represented at a Bible study and lost their lives in that way, and people who really embodied the Spirit of Christ, who forgave his tormentors and persecutors even as he was dying on the cross. And so They really did embody the, as Abraham Lincoln would say, the better angels of our nature.
And this goes back to where sometimes reporters, this was not the response that they expected. Was Charleston going to become Ferguson, Missouri?
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
That.
Ferguson, yeah. Baltimore.
Yeah.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So this was so different.
And let's look at why was that? I mean, not that there still aren't problems in Charleston, but why did the community, and it really did seem to be a community reaction to this incident.
You know, it was immediate. I mean, I was able to leave work and go over to that service at Morris Brown that day, and that's what struck me was just this feeling of, what can I do? How can I help you? Just this coming together. I would say half the people were black and half people were white. I mean, it was immediate. And, you know, the other thing you've got to think about is that the alleged killer was caught the next day, that day, which really helped diffuse the situation. You know, who knows what would have happened if he'd been on the loose and fear had been the biggest emotion, don't you think?
Yep.
You know, and then once the bond hearing, and again, this happened also quick in its quick succession, and then that night there was a big community prayer vigil at TD Arena where the, you know, politicians and clergy all came together with this message of, you know, hate won't win. And after that, there was sort of no turning back from that feeling. I know the next week there were people in town who were trying to agitate for some protest and whatnot, and I participated in a press conference with some folks like Wendell Gelliard and people like that, and they immediately left the event at Emanuel and went over to Marion Square and publicly said, we will not have that here. We don't want outsiders coming in and causing protests, and that was literally a week after. So I think you had on the ground in the community a feeling of just, you know, taking care of one another and what can we do to help? And as the mayor said, our hearts are broken. And then you had the leadership, particularly African-American community, right from the, actually, we've heard stories about that night when people wanted to go out, like sort of vigilante, like we got to go find out who did this. And right from the get-go, the leadership in the church and whatnot was like, no, you, let's just take care of the people who hurt, let the police do their job. So I think when you have the leadership in the church and the police and in the government all saying, let's work together, let's stay together, let's be people, that really helped keep a lid on it, and it just kind of permeated.
Again, the reaction in the city of Charleston itself, Charleston's not Eden, but the sense of community in Charleston, Herb, the Charleston that you grew up in, is a different place now.
A much different place. a much different place. And sometimes I've heard older people who are just a little bit older than me speak of that place in Charleston that I remember in my childhood, and how some of them have been put in tough situations where they thought they were going to be attacked, or there were always kind of skirmishes between black and white kids in the 50s and 60s, but none of it never seemed to reach the level of anything that engulfed the entire city. But looking at the issue of forgiveness and how the city responded, not like a Ferguson, somebody looking from the outside might say that is a sign of weakness, that the black community in Charleston really is not mobilized, does not care. I think that people do care, but people have forgiven, and some have forgiven, but people have not forgotten. And here you are now in a situation where people are beginning to insist that we continue this dialogue, a dialogue, to address some of the issues in Charleston.
And for people who do not know Charleston's history in the 1960s with the garbage strike, with the hospital workers' strike, black Charlestonians did mobilize.
Yes.
But we've got the sense of community, and then, of course, the president comes down mm-hmm. for the memorial service. Mm-hmm. But let's look now at what's happened since then.
Well, the flag came down, you know, and that was, what, July, a few weeks later. And I think everyone got caught up in that. And, you know, we try to explain in the book that it wasn't like it just came down. You know, it took a while, even last July. And, of course, we also want to explain how it got back up there in the first place. And, you know, a bit of that history. So I think that was sort of where a lot of the energy was. And then after that, in Charleston, you began to see different, you know, media events. PBS came down with Gwen Ifill and did a show. A&E came in down and did a show. There were community forums. And it seemed like almost every few weeks we were doing something. The delegation came in to officially announce the nomination process for the Nobel Peace Prize, which did happen in terms of the nomination a few months later. So all these things began to happen. And then Gun Sense formed, which is a really important organization that's now statewide to try to change the gun laws and regulations and what's now become the Charleston loophole, which enabled this young man to get a gun. So you saw a combination of these things start, and a lot of community forums where people were able to voice their feelings about, you know, their own experience with racism, which I don't remember much of that happening before this year. But, mm-hmm.
That's right. That's
you know.
Right. That's right. And some of these efforts were built on a pre-existing ecumenical movement for social justice, the Charleston Area Justice Ministry, which had begun to bring together African Americans and whites across religious lines to work toward the solutions for a variety of social problems in the community. And so there was already some momentum toward social justice that was interracial, and these efforts kind of built on that pre-existing momentum.
Folks, we need to pause for a moment and let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Herb Fraser, Bernie Powers, and Marjorie Wentworth about their book, We Are Charleston, that deals with the tragedy at Mother Emanuel Church. The impact of this event on Mother Emanuel as a congregation, which I think you captured beautifully, but I think it had a different fallout than people might have expected, because this has become something of a national shrine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right, and how would anybody be equipped for that? I mean, one person I interviewed talked about, you know, going into church the next Sunday, and not only was the minister not there, the Sunday school teachers weren't there. The person who, you know, Susie Jackson had all the keys to everything. I mean, the people who were at Bible study were leaders in the church. So you had just this complete change in terms of this vacuum, in a way. And then, of course, all these people who've never even been in the building before who suddenly go to the church. And then dealing with the, you know, my gosh, the media, and then just they've had difficulties. They're now on a new minister is there. That's the third minister in a year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're just trying to get their bearings.
Okay. There has been turmoil in the congregation. I mean, I think you mentioned earlier the two survivors don't worship there anymore.
Well, it's a reminder of going back into that building. That is the hard part. Yes. Mm-hmm. That, you know, they go back and they can't stand to be in that space. And as Marjorie mentioned, now you have all of these other people who are strangers, basically, new people, which is a good thing in one way. But of course, mm-hmm. Emanuel is a very conservative church. Mm-hmm. And we talk about in the book, and even when I was a boy growing up there, we had a place where we sat.
Right.
And if you walked into the church and someone was in your pew, it kind of ruffled your feathers a little bit.
Right. And
that's not peculiar to
that's right.
But those are things that mean a lot to people. I, you know, this woman who was very helpful, Evelyn Sinclair, said it wasn't until October that they could go back in and sit, quote, at their family pew. And you know, they weren't going to say to people, you can't sit there, you know. Right. So those are the things, though, that, you know, you go to church to feel comfortable. It's what you're used to. You know, those are the kind of things that are profound changes. I mean, you have to go into the basement to use the bathroom. Like, you have to go into the room where Bible study occurred if you have to go to the bathroom. And Felicia Sanders is like, that was what she said publicly, like, what if I have to go to the bathroom? I'm so scared. And and family members have talked about maybe going back once. You know, it's never going to be the same. How could it be?
It's just changed in ways that are kind of, well, that were unpredictable, you know. Just the fact that it has become this international place of pilgrimage means that there are always going to be a lot of people who show up at the worship service as merely observers. And that's fine for them to come as observers, but the core congregation feels out of place.
Marjorie said they're on their third pastor in the last year. The book ended with the second one when
she had just been appointed. Dr. Clark,
For whatever reason, the bishop thought it best to send her to Georgetown and send the pastor who was at Bethel Georgetown to Mother Emmanuel.
Well, the members of Emmanuel tell you, some of the leaders in Emmanuel tell you that, you know, there's no blueprint for this.
Right.
They've never experienced this before. So they're, as we say, they're still finding their way. And like any other, all the other tragedies in Emmanuel's history, we're pretty confident within time they'll overcome this one as well.
Well, one of the things that you mentioned that I thought was fascinating is every physical memorial that has been given to that church, whether it's a teddy bear, whether it's a note, what have you, has been saved, archived, thank you notes written where known. And Bernie, as a historian, I mean, there are literally file cabinets full of this
material. Right. And so now the idea that the congregation has, and they're working on this, is in addition to the actual sanctuary, the church owns a couple of buildings adjacent to it, and one of those buildings will be set aside as a museum for some of these memorial artifacts that have been collected over the past year, and those will probably be on some kind of they'll be on display on some kind of a rotating type of a basis.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that Emmanuel, like many other downtown churches in Charleston and elsewhere, the older ones, maintenance of the structure itself is an issue, particularly for a small congregation of several hundred folks.
That's right.
Now, one of the things that happened financially after the shooting was millions of dollars literally came into the congregation, and that became a focal point of contention. Is that correct?
That's right.
To say the least, yes.
Yeah.
That's right, exactly. And, you know, and that's a good example of how something positive, you know, people across the world wanted to do something. They made contributions, but such a tremendous inflow of cash, of money, newfound wealth becomes a source of contention because there were some accusations that the funds had been mismanaged, mishandled. Now, insofar as we know, I think we're of the same mind on this, that after investigations, it has been determined that there was no mishandling of funds. But, you know, it can be just like in a family, you know.
Yes.
People raise questions and people wonder about the allocation of the funds and what one group thinks is fair, others may not think is a fair allocation.
And well, so, you know, I was just you when you said that the money was almost literally rolling in.
Yeah.
And you've got a small church that probably didn't have much of a staff to begin with.
Right.
That's right.
And all of a sudden, you've got checks, you've got cash, you've got an account for it. There was actually a lawsuit filed by one of the victims.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's right.
Husband,
that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
That
that's
was
right.
Since
that's
dismissed.
Right. That's right. And it's been dismissed. It's been dismissed. But yeah.
But it made it even more difficult.
Yeah.
I mean,
sure.
It just,
you know,
sure, sure,
sure. Within the church, some of the people feel as though the church should not have kept any of that money. But they're keeping it, they say, for specific purposes, primarily to fix that building. You know, you look at the building from a distance and it looks beautiful, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But you look up real close, you can see the time is taking its toll on that building and needs a repair.
Well, it wasn't a decision made. Over $3 million was raised, or came in. I wouldn't say raised because the church didn't raise
it.
It just came in.
Right.
A certain portion of that was distributed among the families of the victims. Was that not?
Yes.
Right, and that's happened.
Right.
And that's happened.
That's right.
And the remainder was, Herb, as you said, is going to be used to help maintain the structure.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's such a big adjustment on so many levels, and it's just going to take time. It's never going to be the same. And the other thing, of course, is the trials are going to come up soon, and that's another thing. I mean, you know, you've got to remember that some of the people in the congregation lost 9 of their closest friends as well. And a lot of the people who were at Bible study were related. You know, you had a interconnected family there, the Sanders. So there's all that, too, that people don't necessarily know about from the outside.
Well, is there a silver lining here?
Well, one thing that we'd like to think that changes are going to happen in terms of gun laws and social justice issues based on race. And the other thing, some of the family members started, you know, a literacy fund in honor of Cynthia Graham Hurd, you know, just when Charleston County's cutting their early childhood literacy programs. You know, there's a scholarship fund. Some of percentage of our proceeds goes to that. So positive things are happening.
Didn't the Charleston County Library System
created? Yes.
Yes.
On Cynthia Hurd and Ilana Simmons, the granddaughter of Reverend Simmons, she created an organization, Hate Won't Win.
And she lives here in
Columbia.
Myra Thompson's son started a scholarship fund in honor of his mom. And then there's the Reverend Pinckney Scholarship Fund. And I think there were 10 people got those scholarships this year.
For
so,
sure.
You know, and here we have, again, the families wanting to do good with this, to do something positive, to have an impact, which I think says a lot.
This is a story that is continuing to evolve, but you've got these ongoing community efforts that I think probably are below the radar outside of Charleston.
Probably, yeah.
But since I do read the Post and Courier online, they're still covered locally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a part of community, letting people know what's going on.
And also importantly, I think it's important to note, too, that Bernie laid the history, of course, you know, of the church in Charleston. And you know the church was forced to go underground, was forced out, closed by the city of Charleston. And now here is the first time in the city of Charleston's history that the city is now beginning to pay attention or honor this church. With, you know, that a small portion of Calhoun Street has been renamed the Mother Emanuel Memorial Way. There's been small placards or signs placed at some trees that have been planted on at the newly renovated Gaillard Auditorium, which is the Gaillard Center now. So children moving forward and new visitors to Charleston moving forward can come and get a sense of this church's history and also, more importantly, remember what happened there a year ago.
Herb, talking about remembrance gives me the perfect opportunity to ask, Bernie Powers about the International African American Museum that is going to be built in Charleston. And in terms of full disclosure, I need to let folks know that Dr. Powers and I are both members of the board of directors of that organization.
Yes, yes. And of course, the International African American Museum is going to be practically directly down the street east from the location of Mother Emanuel. The site is particularly important because it's the location known as Gadsden's Wharf, which was in the 18th century probably the longest wharf in North America. And very importantly for what we're talking about, this was really the principal site in which so many African people were imported to South Carolina and funneled to literally as far away by the early years of the 19th century as Louisiana, once the country acquired Louisiana from France. So the museum is going to be it's a memorial site because of the location, but also the museum is designed to talk about the experience of African people in South Carolina, but we'll use South Carolina as a means and as a vehicle for talking about the larger experience of African people in the Caribbean and throughout the Atlantic world.
Well, as you and I both know, historically, 40% of the West Africans imported for slavery came through the port of Charleston.
That's right.
But then if you look at the diaspora out throughout the United States, it is rare for persons of color to not find a South Carolina ancestor somewhere.
That's right. That's right.
And they frequently seek it out as the very important African-American community in Washington, mm-hmm. the South Carolinians
yes.
took the lead in that. And they were, interestingly, in the 1920s, Benjamin Brawley could say, I am proud to be a South Carolinian.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And even today, there are South Carolina clubs up and down the eastern seaboard in major cities, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. And so on and so forth. You know, the other thing about this is that, you know, we talk about the large number of Africans who were imported through the port of Charleston, and then there's a reverse outmigration that occurs also. For example, after the American Revolution, when the British leave, they literally take thousands of Africans with them.
Probably 25,000.
Sure, and many of them would have left from this specific area, and those people become the nuclei for the development of black communities really throughout the maritime provinces of Canada and Great Britain and so on, and some end up going southward down to Jamaica.
And don't forget the Bahamas.
Yes.
Alfred has given me the wind-up sign, folks, and I am sorry because we're having such a great conversation, but any last words? And Herb, I'm going to start with you before we sign off.
Well, I always end with the thought that this tragedy is still with us. We wish that this was a book that we didn't have mm-hmm. to write. Mm-hmm. But we want people to understand that the people who lost their lives were very important people to their families and the community, and we must always remember those five people who survived. But more importantly, that we must continue the dialogue so this does not happen again, so we can have better understanding of our relationships in this community and in this state.
Okay. Thank you. Bernie?
And I would just call attention to the title of the book, We Are Charleston. And we came up with that title because the three of us We're in Charleston, and we're Charleston observers and residents, but also because we think that there's so much in this story, in the experience that we describe there, that people in other places will be able to identify with. And we hope that that is the case. And certainly that theme of forgiveness comes up again, and we have to remember that. If we expect to be forgiven, we have to be forgiving too. Mm-hmm. Okay. We are Charleston.
Okay, Marjorie.
Well, and I would just kind of add to that that the best thing we can do to pay respect and honor those we lost is to try to be more like them. I mean, all of them were teachers and ministers and coaches and, you know, worked in the community just like Reverend Pinckney. They didn't separate their faith from their work life. I mean, it was all seamless. And, you know, we could all do a little bit better at that. And I think that's something to think about and really continue the work that he was doing and really keep pressing forward, you know, to make everyone's life better here, which is what his wife Jennifer is asking for.
The title of the book is We Are Charleston, Tragedy and Triumph at Mother Emanuel. Herb Frazier, Dr. Bernard Powers, and our poet laureate Marjorie Wentworth, thanks so much for being with us today on The Journal.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This is Walter Edgar, and normally I say, I hope you enjoyed today's journal. I don't think enjoy is the term I would like to use today. I hope you learned something from today's journal. The events of June 2015 in Charleston had an impact on all of us who live in South Carolina, and the way with which my guests brought this story together in a historical context, but also as sort of a jumping off point for a continuing discussion of what happened, why it happened, and who we are as South Carolinians, is something I think we all need to consider. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.